there was no commitment from the Taliban side to reduce to stop fighting.
But now a new agreement says they will. This is Thursday, December 3rd, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Millman. Also coming your way, young activists will spend time in a Hong Kong jail. Some are saying the fractured Australia-China relationship can be repaired. Brits will have a COVID vaccine available next week, helping the aging with virtual reality. That and more on today's VOA Asia. Afghan government and Taliban representatives say they've reached a preliminary deal to press on with peace talks, the first written agreement in 19 years of war and welcomed by the United States as a chance to halt the violence. Joining us is Ayaz Ghul, who reports for VOA from Islamabad, Pakistan. Ayaz, tell us more about this, how it came about, what it means.
It is being dubbed a breakthrough development because for the last nearly 3 months, both the Taliban and Afghan government negotiators were basically trying to put together a framework for substantive negotiations to discuss a permanent ceasefire and a political power-sharing agreement to bring this 40 years war to an end.
With all the violence that continues to go on inside Afghanistan, why is this considered a breakthrough?
Well, the expectation, particularly from the United States, was that once this formal dialogue, the intra-Afghan negotiations begin, there will be a serious reduction in violence in Afghanistan in order to provide some confidence-building measures to both the sides and to create an atmosphere or an environment where finally the two sides start discussing a permanent ceasefire. So this is true that there is a lot of violence going on, and there were some misunderstanding also from the outset when the U.S. signed this historic peace agreement with the Taliban in February this year. There was no commitment from the Taliban side to stop fighting, but they did promise to reduce violence, which although we did not see on the battlefield, in fact, there was serious intensification in violence over the past 3 months, and that threatened this whole peace process to be derailed. But now we are expecting, and this is what the Taliban have been saying, that once the formal dialogue begins and they start discussing the power sharing deal and a comprehensive ceasefire, they are going to reduce violence. Now, that is what they have pledged during the negotiations with the United States, and that's what they have been saying publicly. What happens actually during this formal dialogue, as and when it starts, we don't know, because there are so many actors on the battlefield in Afghanistan. It's not only the Taliban and Afghan security forces who have been fighting each other. It's the Islamic State loyalists in the country who have also been, planting big attacks, deadly attacks in the country. So who will ultimately take responsibility for the continuation of violence, whether the Taliban or the Afghan government, or will the United States will have to play more role in order to ensure that there is a reduction in violence so that the two sides can move forward and discuss a ceasefire?
What do you think will be the effect of a Biden administration change from Donald Trump as far as this agreement is concerned and as far as the situation in Afghanistan as far as violence is concerned?
Well, what we understand from the statements that President-elect Biden has given, that he is for maintaining a small counterterrorism U.S. force in Afghanistan to make sure that there is no threat to the United States from this country again by transnational terrorist groups. But in the agreement between the U.S. and the Taliban, it has been clearly stated that, and that that's what the Taliban have been demanding, that not a single foreign soldier will remain in Afghanistan by May next year. So if President-elect Biden continues with some presence of U.S. forces in Afghanistan, that will, according to many analysts, threaten the very existence of the agreement between the U.S. and the Taliban, which has actually led to the start of this intra-Afghan dialogue.
Ayaz Gul joining us from Islamabad, Pakistan. Ayaz, as always, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now at voanews.com. A Chinese spacecraft collects moon samples to take back to Earth. Australia will sign a military deal with U.S. ally Japan. Singapore okays lab-grown chicken. Benazir Bhutto's daughter officially enters Pakistani politics. After arriving in Cambodia, Kaban no longer is the world's loneliest elephant. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia and at voanews.com. This is VOA Asia. Authorities in Hong Kong today jailed 24-year-old pro-democracy activist Joshua Wong over an unlawful anti-government rally in 2019. Wong is one of Hong Kong's most prominent pro-democracy activists. Two other activists were also jailed. 23-year-old Agnes Chow was jailed for participating and inciting others to participate in the protest, while 26-year-old Ivan Lam received his sentence on a charge of incitement. For more, VOA's Jason Patinkin reached out to journalist Ria Mogul in Hong Kong.
This is not a sentencing under the city's new sweeping national security laws. Joshua Wong has been given a sentence of 13 and a half months. This will be his third time to enter prison in his entire life. Agnes Chow has been given a sentence of 10 months. This will be her first time. Then Ivan Lam has been given a 7-month sentence. So that's what we know so far. They have been denied bail and they were taken straight to the prison from the court this evening in Hong Kong.
So what exactly did the court convict them of doing? I guess, what is it that they did?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question, definitely. So the case centers around perhaps one of the most striking scenes from the early days of the protests last year in Hong Kong. So hundreds of thousands of protesters swamped the area outside police headquarters in one of the central districts in Hong Kong. And what's interesting is that last year's anti-government protests were a leaderless movement. There was no one person that sat at the helm of the entire almost 11-month movement. So people online have expressed their outrage that Joshua Wong, Agnes Chow, and Ivan Lam have been sentenced for organizing this protest when essentially it was just sort of this leaderless, very kind of organic gathering. The prosecution, however, of course, positioned the three of them as the leaders of the protest, in particular painted Wong as the leader of the protest because he gave a speech that night in front of all of the thousands of protesters and he urged them to, you know, stay put and besiege the police headquarters.
Now, Hong Kong has had a lot more freedoms than mainland China. And as you said, this was not under Hong Kong's new national security law. So, you know, protesting, gathering in large numbers, speaking out, was that actually against the law in Hong Kong?
Well, that, again, is an interesting question. I suppose there's a gray area when it comes to that. It was definitely not illegal to gather and protest in Hong Kong. Hong Kong was the only place on Chinese soil that every year held a vigil to commemorate, for instance, the Tiananmen Square massacre that occurred, and thousands of people would gather to do that. However, the protest last year in question that was brought up in court today was not an authorized gathering. So that essentially means that a letter of no objection was not issued to a particular group for people to be able to gather. So essentially it was an illegal gathering, but protests prior to the national security law were not illegal, provided that they had a letter of no objection from the police.
And what's the reaction been to these sentences, both in Hong Kong and internationally?
So in Hong Kong, of course, many Hong Kongers have taken to social media to express their frustration, their anger over what they see as an unfair sentence. There's been a lot of talk, you know, about how young all three of these activists are. Joshua Wong turned 24 years old in October. Agnes Chow, she's 23. It's in fact her birthday this coming Friday. People have expressed their sadness that she's going to spend her birthday in prison. And Ivan Lam is only 26 years old. So what's pretty outstanding is just this youth. You know, they're all so young, and people have been expressing just they're upset that this is what's happening to a lot of Hong Kong youth. And internationally, there has been some statements that have been put out by foreign ministers and leaders of other countries. For instance, the British Foreign Secretary urged authorities to bring an end to what he characterized as a campaign to stifle opposition here in Hong Kong. And Taiwan's president, Tsai Ing-wen, she also put out a statement on Twitter and social media to express her upset over today's sentencing.
That's journalist Rhea Mogul in Hong Kong. Rhea, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Happening now in Asia. Joe Biden tells the New York Times he will not immediately cancel the Phase 1 trade agreement that President Trump struck with China, nor take steps to remove tariffs on Chinese exports. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We are happy you're with us on VOA Asia. As Australia's diplomatic and economic relationship with China sinks to new lows, analysts believe the partnership can be repaired. The two countries clashed over a tweet of alleged war crimes in Afghanistan shared by China's Ministry of Foreign Affairs. From Sydney, Phil Mercer has more.
China is engaging in a so-called tongue war against Australia as an example to other countries, according to analysts. Relations have deteriorated in recent years over allegations of Chinese interference in Australian politics and cyber espionage. There's been disagreement over Beijing's military expansion in the South China Sea and democracy in Hong Kong. Canberra's call for a global investigation into the origins of the new coronavirus, first detected in the Chinese city of Wuhan, was interpreted as an infuriating slight against China. Political tensions hit new lows Monday when China's Ministry of Foreign Affairs posted a doctored image of an Australian soldier holding a bloody knife to the throat of a child. It was a provocative reference to a recent report that detailed alleged atrocities perpetrated by Australian special forces in Afghanistan. Canberra angrily demanded an apology for the shameful tweet, but Beijing accused Australia of attempting to stoke domestic nationalism. Chinese diplomats said the rage and roar of some Australian politicians and media was an overreaction. Resetting ties with its biggest trading partner won't be easy for Australia. But experts believe that quiet, sensible diplomacy can eventually repair the damage, and that Australia shouldn't have reacted in such a combative way to China's war crimes tweet. Professor Jane Golley is the director of the Australian Centre on China in the World at the Australian National University.
surely we don't want an enemy that is that strong and powerful in the world. You know, even if they're doing things at the moment that we really don't agree with or like, I'm going to continue to believe that there is scope for an engagement strategy that reduces the long-term risks and bringing benefits, you know, to the millions of people here and the billion or 1.4 billion over there as well. We're all humans after all, but I still don't think that that antagonistic approach is the best one for the years ahead.
Trade with China has underpinned Australia's recent prosperity. 40% of its exports have been sold to Chinese buyers, and Australia is a source of food and strategic minerals, including iron ore. But recent diplomatic disputes have coincided with China imposing tariffs and restrictions on a range of products, including wine, barley, beef and coal, that could cost Australia billions of dollars in lost revenue. China also warned its citizens not to travel or study in Australia because of fears of racism fueled by COVID-19. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
After you listen to VOA Asia, see it. VOA Asia is on YouTube. See and share the fun with Food Bites, our weekly culinary dive into foods from the homeland. Recipes that came with chefs who immigrated to the United States. Students enrolling in U.S. schools can get their first lessons about life on campus. Subscribe for free and see us often on VOA Asia YouTube.
This news from VOA Asia. Bangladesh has begun preparations to move thousands of Rohingya refugees to a remote island off of its coast, officials said Wednesday, despite opposition from many refugees and human rights groups who have termed it an island detention center. All of the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Britain has given emergency approval to a new COVID-19 vaccine developed by U.S.-based pharmaceutical giant Pfizer, becoming the world's first Western nation ready to begin mass inoculations against a disease that has sickened nearly 64 million people worldwide, including more than 1.4 million deaths. The government's Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Authority granted approval Wednesday for the vaccine, which Pfizer developed along with Germany's BioNTech. The first vaccinations will begin next week with staffers of Britain's National Health Service, nursing home residents, and staffers expected to receive first priority. As it has for months, the United States continues to lead the world in coronavirus infections with nearly 13.7 million cases and more than 270,000 deaths, according to the Johns Hopkins Coronavirus Research Center. The coronavirus pandemic largely hit urban areas first in the United States, but the fall surge is now devastating rural America. More on that from VOA's Mariama Diallo.
The U.S. is now averaging more than 170,000 new cases a day. This is affecting not only large hospitals in cities, but also smaller ones like Scotland County Hospital in rural Missouri. Chief Nurse Elizabeth Guffey says they are seeing a 30% positivity rate.
That's one in three patients tested is testing positive. Our increase in hospitalizations is definitely there. Over the last 2 to 3 weeks, we've definitely seen at least half of our patients in the emergency room have been known COVID positive prior to walking through our doors.
People come to the 25-bed hospital from six surrounding counties to be treated for farm and sports injuries, chest pains, and the flu. Usually, there is plenty of room. Not now. The small hospital with roughly six doctors and 75 nurses among 142 full-time staff is in crisis.
Staffing has been the biggest challenge. You still have all the other things that happen in regular life in addition to now COVID. And we have the majority of our staff are young mothers. So if your kid gets sent home or quarantined or schools go on virtual learning or all of those other situations also affect our ability to bring in staff every day.
Nurses are working extra shifts to cover hospital needs, says Guffey.
Right now we are tapped and maxed out at our resources, and it's very difficult to incur even more patients every day.
Out of more than 13.5 million coronavirus cases in the U.S., the state of Missouri has over 306,000 confirmed cases and over 3,800 deaths, according to a tally by Johns Hopkins University. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
A message from your friends at VOA Asia. Can the coronavirus survive in cold weather? Can the virus be spread by mosquito bites? Is there a vaccine or medication that prevents it? Is there any medicine that cures it? The answer to all of the questions is no. The best steps to take: wash your hands, cover your cough, stay at home if you're sick or advised to by local authorities. A message from your friends at VOA Asia.
Thank you for being with us on VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. The number of people aged 65 and older is growing faster around the world than any other age group, according to the United Nations. It's often painful and frustrating caring for someone who's suffering from age-related challenges linked to cognitive decline, dementia, hearing, and visual problems. Virtual reality is now being used to help caregivers develop more understanding and empathy so they can better interact with the elderly. VOA's Elizabeth Lee has the details on how it works.
Emma.
Who is that?
Imagine having Alzheimer's disease or having a hard time seeing and hearing. These age-related health challenges can now be experienced through virtual reality or VR.
It's part of our own future of aging. So if we can see ourselves in older people that might have these slight changes, just a matter of patience and knowledge could help reduce the stress and stigma of that disease.
Carrie Shaw founded Embodied Labs, a company that immerses a user into the world of the elderly to better understand their reality. The experiences include hearing the confusion related to memory loss from Alzheimer's to visual impairment. Shaw's mother suffered from Alzheimer's disease. She realized even professional caregivers found it challenging interacting with her mother.
Some would treat her like a child, and she would sense that and, you know, she would kind of push back and say, I don't want to be talked down to like I'm a child.
The company offers the software and hardware needed for the VR experience to help users develop empathy.
Today we use a live-action film that's also blended into a game engine so it becomes interactive.
Jamie Hannons uses Embodied Labs to train nursing students. She says this VR experience with macular degeneration opened her eyes.
When you're in the headset, looking kind of to the side to view what's going on. I saw that tilt and I thought, I've seen that with patients so many times and not recognized it as an opportunity to say, how's your vision?
Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Art therapy can be part of working through past trauma. Maxim Moskalkov tells us the story of sexual assault survivors who have turned therapy into a thriving business that also helps other women survivors.
Cousins Ellie Clogerty and Kristen Malinowski grew up in Northern Virginia and both headed to Virginia Tech to get a degree in neurobiology. The young women had a lot in common. One of the big things, both say they are survivors of campus sexual assault. As part of their recovery, the two launched a jewelry line called Camaria.
When I started designing jewelry, I went from an idea of something that wasn't in existence yet, and you could just find a way to bring it to life.
The young women started studying jewelry making in New York and traveled the world to learn different jewelry styles. A year after Camaria was launched, Clogerty and Malinowski started a nonprofit called Restore Dignity that offers financial help to the victims of campus sexual assault. 10% of Camaria's proceeds go to the Restore Dignity.
You would be surprised to know that we have had applications from students who are having their diplomas held until they pay their student health care costs, and those student health care costs were directly attributed to sexual assault.
Many jewelry pieces that Clogerty and Malinowski make are asymmetrical. The cousins say they are meant to show beauty in imperfection.
It's so meaningful, and it's easy to attach symbology to something so small.
One of our signature pieces is the butterfly necklace, and the butterfly represents hope and transformation, which is a good reminder for survivors.
The young women believe the COVID pandemic has taught people to be more empathetic towards each other. They say these times are forcing many people to lead very isolated lives, like the ones sexual assault victims often lead.
Tamaria means moonlight in Swahili, so the idea is, like the moon, even when you're surrounded by darkness, you reflect light just because you exist.
We're going to support...
Maxim Moskalkov for VOA News, Washington.
Thanks for being with us. Thanks to our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Jim Stevenson, Keith Lane, and Doug Bernard. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Stay safe and enjoy the day ahead.